So here we are with Mike Bove, cinematographer for Uncle John, the just-released thriller from Stephen Pyatt and Eric Crary, starring John Ashton. How's it going, Mike?
I'm doing very well. How are you this evening?
I'm so well. Thanks for asking. This is going to be more Q&A than traditional back-and-forth podcast. Now to the questions. So Uncle John is sort of this weird genre mashup, which is, I think, a big element that distinguishes it from other small thrillers, in that it's not just a thriller, it's also sort of a romantic comedy. Was this their sort of intention all along, or did it evolve from them combining two separate movies together?
That was always their idea, according to them, because they had never seen anything like it before, so it's something that they wanted to explore. And I think it also just, you know, it gives them freedom to try out two different genres,
right,
to see if they, first of all, you know, range, being able to do different things, but then ultimately combining them, I think, creates a compelling third act. So that was their idea all along, basically, because they hadn't seen it before, so it was unique. Now, me, upon reading it, I admit I was skeptical, because it is very different. I'd certainly never read or seen anything like that before, so, you know, no one really knows how it will work.
Right.
So I guess it was quite a gamble in that sense, but I do think it works.
Yeah.
You know, so it's cool. I like it.
So when you read the script, were the scenes did they read very differently? Because, I mean, like, when you see the movie, it all flows together, mm-hmm, because the way you guys filmed it, like, visually, it seems of a piece, but, like, I could imagine there just being a very different sort of tone to the scenes with Uncle John and the scenes with his nephew, mm-hmm, you know, especially like when they're in Chicago still.
Well, you know, and I'm speaking a little bit for Stephen and Eric here, but just based on what we've talked about and what I've heard him say in interviews is there's different stakes. So each environment has different stakes. You think in the city, things would maybe be a bit more violent, but it's actually in the country where the violence is taking place.
Right.
And you think that the small idyllic town is where the more mundane things happen, but that's actually what is happening in the city. So they juxtapose those ideas just with, you know, things that could be a little under the surface.
I guess my question was just, you know, like, Uncle John doesn't say much. He's talked at a lot of the time, which is
right,
cool. Because you know what he's thinking based on what everyone else is saying,
mm-hmm,
about him, sort,
mm-hmm,
of. It establishes that. But a lot of his scenes are, like, very visual.
Sure.
So they probably read differently than the sort of chatty back-and-forth stuff.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that jumped out, you know, when reading the script. It's a lot of the dialogue takes place in the Chicago realm of the story. A lot of the action without dialogue takes place in the Wisconsin rural. So, I don't know, immediately in my mind, I'm thinking about how to differentiate the environments, because it's essentially two whole different feels.
Right.
And a lot of that happened just based on the environment that we were in. For instance, in Wisconsin, you get a lot of golden hues, greens, more of those kinds of colors. But then when we're shooting here, it's just naturally
cool,
more concrete, cold. I did subtle changes, you know, with the color temperature and things like that to accentuate it. So visually, they're already very separate, so there wasn't much that was needed to be done there.
Hmm.
And the camera work is similar in both stories as well. So
right,
that they're connected like that, but just based on the color palette of the locations, they are separate. I don't know if that answers your question at all.
It does, and actually it takes me to, like, another question.
Okay.
It sort of answers a lot of what I was about to ask, which was, in terms of, like, the camera style, it's a lot of handheld, a lot of natural lighting.
Mm-hmm.
Was that something you guys had sort of planned based on where they were coming from tonally, or was that something that you thought would be a way to expedite, you know, your day so you could make your day and get as many shots and setups done as possible? Was it a combination?
Yeah, I would say it's more of the latter.
Oh, really?
It honestly came, it sounds bad to say this, but it didn't come from, it was born out of the budget.
Out of necessity.
Yeah.
Well, that's
so,
like, how a lot of good stuff happens.
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
That's a good thing.
You know, the initial idea was to have a lot more dolly shots and things of this name, you know, quote-unquote movie-style shots. But once Steven and Eric realized that that budget wasn't going to be there. Well, they still wanted to make the movie, so they chose to adopt this other style based out of necessity. And once that was settled on, it just became the visual language that we used to shoot it. There were a lot of limitations, but we all embraced them. And yeah, the entire movie is handheld. We embraced the doc style sort of thing because of budget and because of the time frame. We shot in 16 days.
Oh, wow.
So it's pretty quick, and there was literally no room in the budget for overtime for SAG. So every day ended at exactly 12 hours. So being nimble and being handheld and utilizing natural light allowed us to just keep an insane pace.
That's awesome. Yeah. That makes sense. And I mean, you have a lot of different locations considering you shot in 16 days.
Yeah,
for
sure.
It's not a short movie. It's 113 minutes. So, damn.
It was very intense. But honestly, the handheld thing, once we got into it, it was pretty fun, and it was easy to adapt to, almost like not having to worry about anything else, because the way we ended up working was, I mean, there was a very general shot list, like, here's some ideas and what we think we need, but what ended up happening a lot of the time is we'd start a scene, and Pi and I would stand back, and we'd watch the talent run through their blocking with the scene while they rehearsed. And while they were doing that, I was planning out in my head the master shot. Like, okay, so I think I can start here, and then when John walks here, I'm going to wrap around into an over-the-shoulder, and then I'm going to back out to a two-shot. So I was thinking about that dance I was going to do while I watched them rehearse their blocking. And then I discussed it with Pyatt. We would agree on something. We would try it. If it worked, great. We would try it again. If it didn't work, we would refine from there. And then after we got that master is when we picked off whatever coverage we felt we needed. So that was the approach that we used. And it really seemed to work. It was very, I mean, again, we had like a structure, but I'd be lying if I said we really were looking at the shot list every day.
Wow.
Yeah. A lot of times we would reference it like, oh yeah, we can't forget like this little thing that we wanted, that little thing. But as far as the master shot and the coverage, it was more or less come up with on the spot. There were a couple big ideas that Steven had, of which we executed one that no one ever sees in the movie, which I see as a plus because it's a 5-minute take.
Oh, really?
Uninterrupted take. Yeah, because we had talked about doing a couple of these longer takes, and ultimately we decided to only do one, and we blocked out half a day to do it, which with our schedule was, you know, kind of crazy. Wow, like we're going to take half a day to shoot this one shot, but we did it, and I think the way that we ended up doing it, no one ever notices it. So I like that because I don't think it should draw attention to itself. It's when Danny sees Ben and pulls over on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's like, oh, well, let me get out of here and do this proper. And he backs in, you know?
Oh.
So when he gets out of his truck, that's a 5-minute take from when he walks up to Kate and Ben.
And then
they all walk into the garage and then out of the garage. So no one ever really notices that, which I enjoy.
Wow.
Yeah, and that was a lot of fun to do, honestly, because that was like a challenge, you know, just with the way to block it realistically, camera-wise and character-wise.
It
was a fun little puzzle. Not that there was like we had a big set piece or anything. There was four characters in a fairly open space, but it was tricky because, you know, they walk into a dark garage, and, you know, how do I... You know,
light it.
There were aperture racks. There was no lighting. I was just racking aperture, basically. So I had stopped down to, I think, a 5.6. And then when John enters the garage, there's like a moment when I pan off of him to the door opening. And as the door opens, if you watch closely, you will see it gradually get two stops brighter outside. And then when he leaves, you can hide aperture racks in camera moves, you know, if you do it right. So
if it's blurry enough, whatever.
Right. When there's motion blur and you can't, you know, a lot of things going on. So all of that sort of thought process. It was a fun challenge. But I just remember everyone was especially a little stressed for that because, again, we were spending such a long time on it. It's like, well, is this worth it? I mean, there were a lot of conversations. Like, should we break this down and do it more traditionally?
Yeah.
But ultimately, Pi just said, no, we're going to do it. And I think it'll work. And we did. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, credit to that guy.
Seriously.
Because you're locking yourself into an edit. That's scary.
Yeah.
We did a lot of oners, actually, in the movie. That ended up playing as oners. And I remember, for instance, when Ben brings when the girl brings Ben over her apartment.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That shitty girl. We were shooting that, and I just, again, we were shooting the master shot, just a wide two-shot profile. After we were done, Steven just looks at me. He's like, I don't think we need anything else here. I'm like, really, man? He's like, yeah, we're good. Like, let's just move, which is, I think that's so ballsy because, you know, in a good way, because you know your movie better than me, and you know how it's going to cut. You're
right.
Doing this in one long take, and that's all you can do at this point because you haven't got any coverage. That's very it takes courage to do that, but I think it works. So
it's a one shot when they go to her apartment,
right? And back to what I was saying about the no coverage, it was just one take with these two fantastic improv actors, Alex Moffat and Tawny Newsome. And we ran through it four times, which, by the way, each time was just absolutely hilarious. They just pulled out different material each time. And I was hoping that, like, there was so much good there. I was like, oh, like, now we're going to go in to get the coverage so that way Pi can, like,
get everything.
These, like, crazy things.
Yeah,
but he ended up not wanting anything. And, you know, just use the one take, which I think is fine.
It kind of fits because the movie is a lot about, like, sort of living in the atmosphere of a scene. So,
sure.
Like, there's not the fast-cutting thing wouldn't
right.
really fit, I
it
guess.
It fits with the tone of the film, for
yeah.
sure. So I get what he was going for.
Yeah, for sure. But, I mean, again, as a cinematographer, your instinct would be, well, you know,
yeah.
Let's be safe.
Exactly. Let's be safe. No time for safety these days.
I feel that. So, Pyatt and Crary, you guys have worked together for a while. And I was reading an interview with, I think, both of them, where they were talking about how, you know, they were working towards getting a certain amount of money, and
yes.
then that sort of fell through.
Yes.
But they sort of, the way that they decided to do it is they stuck to a strict schedule where it's like, if we don't get X amount of money, we're going to go with Y amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll shoot it on our phones if we have to. Like, we're going to shoot a feature.
Right.
Like, that was, they were very about
right.
it. So I was wondering, like, how long this project's sort of been gestating, how long you've been involved with it, and
okay.
what you can say about, like, their first feature experience as director and producer.
Sure. So I was first told about it in March of 2013, and then we ended up shooting August of 2013. So about, you know, 4 or 5 months prior, but they had been writing it for, God, I don't know. I'm not sure how long, but I know that the winter of 2012, like December, I believe, is when they decided, like, they were going to make it. So I don't know if it was written by then or not. It was around that time they said, okay, we're going to shoot this sometime next summer, probably August. So
no matter what.
Yeah, which that, you know, I love that line of thinking. And then just making the different plans with the budgets, I think, is really smart because, like I said before, you know, the initial plan was to shoot it very traditionally. But then once that wasn't a reality, you know, they didn't let themselves get bogged down in that, and they were still going to make it. So I admire that tenacity. And I was told about it initially in March, and I probably got a script in May or June. I don't recall. And then, you know, I was just chatting with them about it on and off. And then I did a job with them in late July, I want to say. And I asked him what the status was. He's like, oh, like, well, we're preparing to move on it. Like, we're doing it. And that's around the time that they officially brought me on.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a whole lot of prep time. 2 to 3 weeks, I would say.
Wow.
Yeah, in which time, you know, I was already acquainted with the script, but I really went over it with a fine-tooth comb, wrote out all my ideas. Turns out there were a lot of very similar ideas with Steven, so we were on the same page with that, which was nice. And then we did a couple extensive location scouts, and discussed strategy and, you know, made overheads and the whole bit, booked crew, booked camera, figured out what kind of lighting I can get and when, like all that stuff happened in a very short time span. And then, yeah, we started shooting end-ish of August and went through mid-September.
Crazy.
Yeah, it was nuts.
Seriously, man. Well, I was talking to Weldon recently because he's on his first feature I think October is when he finishes.
Oh, really? Okay, because yeah. I don't know what that guy's doing. Maybe.
Yeah, but he hasn't been sleeping. Like, he doesn't, like, he'll take days to get back to you, but
yeah.
He'll just be like, yeah, dude, I'm so confused. Like, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So, like, was it like that for you? You just, like, went underground, like, didn't know what day it was, didn't get any sleep? Like, I don't know. I feel like it's got to be very immersive, the first feature.
Oh, yeah. I mean, after it was over, it's like you kind of it's kind of maybe coming out of, like, a night of drunken debauchery. The next morning, you're like, God, like, what? What happened? My head's spinning. Like, I'm dizzy. I don't recall.
Right, so there's a bit of that. You do go underground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing that I remember is, you know, with how fast the schedule was, it was just, like, decision, 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 decision. You have to make so many decisions really, really quickly, some of them which are, like, very important things that require, like, typically a lot of consideration, but you just have to be like, choose. And
this is how we're going
forward. Yeah, and you just hope that, I don't know, it's like a blur. The night that we wrapped, it was kind of an overnight. I think we wrapped at like 3 or something, and then I was on a plane 3 hours later for the next job. So it's like, it was just, it was a crazy time. No regrets. YOLO. And then I remember the first time I saw the cut, I'm just like, oh, well, shit, that cuts together pretty well. Go figure.
We did it, guys.
Yeah. The attention and success it has had is beyond my wildest dreams. So it's awesome. I'm just glad people like it.
Man, it's like you read these questions before because I was going to ask you something along those lines.
Oh, really? Right? Wait, you were?
Yeah, no, I was. Oh. That actually wasn't the question. he did read the questions before, you guys. But that's super exciting. It got picked up by Film Buff. It's on video on demand in iTunes. I got it on iTunes.
It's currently number one on indie new releases.
No shit.
Yeah.
This is something I've always been wondering. Like, do they know exactly how much money it makes, like, from video? Because no one ever talks about how much money these things make from video or on demand or, like, Netflix arrangements or whatever. And can you see how many people watch or rent it from those various avenues?
I can't.
But can they? Like, could
Film
you ask
can.
For it?
Oh, Film Buff can. I don't know if I can get that information if I ask for it. So maybe I almost don't want to know.
Yeah, well, it's number one, though, right? I mean,
right,
that's awesome.
Right. I don't know. I do not have access to those kinds of metrics, although I would be curious.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. I don't know, it's one of those things that I always wonder about. And then, I guess, sort of on the flip side of that, have you been looking at their reviews? They've been really good.
I have been, yeah. I love reading the bad ones.
Well, the LA Times didn't love it. I saw that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But New York Times
that was
totally
crazy.
Loved it.
I know.
Yeah.
That was really cool.
And New York Times, no offense, LA Times, trumps the LA Times. So, I mean
it's
worth like twice.
Like deep.
Yeah.
Also, there's a film critic called Rex Reed. Eric told me about it today. I guess he had a really good review of it as well.
The New York Times review was from Neil Genslinger. And yeah, it was a critic's pick. So
yeah, which is really cool.
It's pretty awesome.
It definitely, I'm sure, helped.
So you used your Alexa?
Yeah, we shot it on my Alexa. And I own a set of Cook Mini S4 Primes, which, you know, it's a bit of the reason why I bought that camera. Is I was able to package it with myself for something exactly like this was the idea. Obviously, had to work a crazy discount, but it's a discount that I would not have been able to get through a rental house, no matter how good my relationship was with the rental house. So yeah, I mean, it just kind of worked out with their budget, because my whole argument was, well, we don't really have a lighting package or crew, so
let's get an awesome camera.
Yeah, like, let's shoot on the best acquisition format that we can possibly afford. I really pushed for it, and they wanted to do it too, and the money was there, so it worked out. But we had to pare down a lot of stuff. Like, there was no bells and whistles, really. It was camera, lenses, you know, matte box, follow focus, and an onboard monitor. There wasn't even a director's monitor. I remember this is before like Teradek and Paralynx and cheap wireless HD was a thing. So I rented an SD wireless down converter box. So Steven had this little, you know, standard def UHD monitor with like an antenna, and that's how he would view. There was no director's monitor really.
So it looks like one of those like kitchen TVs that you sort of watch when you're doing the dishes.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, yeah, it was a small little handheld guy, and he basically just watched it for framing reference because, you know, it was getting a UHF signal, so it was very staticky and like, you know, coming in and out. I remember that thing was kind of a pain.
So it's in Lodi, Wisconsin. You guys get sort of, I know, like, from my experience, when a production's in town and it's a small town, you try to, like, get in there and get the community behind it.
Right.
So, you know, you use local shops, local vendors, yep, as much as you can. You get the publicity going. You take as many interviews as you can,
mm-hmm,
so that people are aware and excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you guys did that?
Well, that was all pretty easy because Eric's from Lodi.
Aha.
Yeah, so he already knew a lot of the people and was able to source, you know, all the locations just from that. And it really was a community effort. Everyone in their own way pitched in. They were all really excited to just, you know, be around that environment and see it happen. It's just something very unusual for them. So I think everyone did enjoy it. And honestly, you know, Eric will thank them to the end of his days. We could have not have gotten this done without everyone's help up there. So it was really nice. Great community.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. So we should clarify, that's Eric Crary, the producer and co-writer that we're talking about. All right, now to the actors really fast as our wrap-up, unless we think of something else.
Do it.
So the improv scene in Chicago, Alex Moffi, who plays Ben, is at a bar with Kate, and he's like saying some stuff you would never hear in a normal romantic comedy. It turns out that a lot of that was improvised. It was one of those things like the hookup scene where he just sort of riffed and they captured it, or was it something where, like Scorsese does this, where they do the improv in a rehearsal, and then, so maybe like during blocking or whatever, and then they lock it in, and then they shoot the designated bit a bunch of times?
It was maybe a bit of both of those environments. Yeah, because I remember that the way the dialogue was structured for those scenes was written out, but Pyatt did allow them to go off course as long as they came back.
They landed in the right spot.
Yeah, so
it's like Curb or something.
Yeah, every take may have been a little different in its own way, but ultimately that stuff was pretty scripted.
Cool.
Versus, you know, other scenes in the movie. So just dependent on what he was going for, I guess.
Gotcha. Okay, awesome. So you mentioned before that that Alex Moffat was from, he's an improv guy. He's
mm-hmm.
based out of Chicago, right?
Not anymore. He's in LA these days.
Aha.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but he is from here.
And was it after Uncle John that he made that migration?
Yeah, he was talking about it during, because he had an opportunity out there for some sort of pilot. So he knew he was going even before he started filming with us.
Right, right.
Yeah, so that was a foregone conclusion, and he's been there ever since.
And let's see. Oh, so Jenna Ling, were most of these people like LA people, I guess, besides Alex Moffat and some of the local folks that were in the smaller roles? Like, I mean, obviously John Ashton,
mm-hmm.
but Jenna Ling, and then Ronnie Jean Blevins must have been LA.
Ashton actually lives in Colorado.
Really?
Yeah. I want to say Colorado Springs. I don't know. He lives in Colorado full time. And it's funny. He actually, he drove out to our set.
Really?
Yeah. He just is like, you know, he just wanted like a road trip. So I remember, you know, when he shows up, he's like in this, you know, Tommy Bahama kind of, you know, Hawaiian t-shirt, just chomping on a cigar with like flip-flops, driving this huge GMC truck.
Dude, hell yeah.
Oh, it was just such a like, oh boy. But yeah, Jenna's from LA. I forget how they found her. And then I believe Ronnie is from LA as well. And it's interesting how they found John and Ronnie, because they just reached out to them directly. They somehow found their personal email. And
IMDb Pro, man. Right?
Okay, yeah,
probably,
no doubt.
Possibly.
I do not know their methods, but
that's very smart.
To my knowledge, they just reached out to them directly, said, "Hey, here's who we are, here's what we are, we're really small, but here's our script, let us know. And both of them were chomping at the bit as soon as they read it, which is really cool.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, so once they were interested, then they're like, okay, well, you know, then they got the whole agent thing involved. I don't know how that all worked, but they got on, so.
Yeah.
And then, like I say, Jenna, they found her through a casting agency in L.A.
Okay.
And I'm not sure, you know, how they had her read. But yeah, everyone was great, honestly. Not a bad apple in the bunch, so.
Nice.
Yeah.
And then on Ronnie Jean Blevins, he's like a bad guy in a lot of movies.
Yep.
He's in The Dark Knight. Ah, fuck, I have to go.
He's in Joe.
Oh, yeah, he's in The Dark Knight. He's in Joe, which is that Nicolas Cage movie where he's like a backwoods.
It's a good movie.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Did I say David Gordon Green directed it? Maybe I didn't. David Gordon Green directed it. What else is he in?
I think he had a role in Sons of Anarchy. He's very prolific. People always say he looks like Peter Sarsgaard.
He looks like a slimy Peter Sarsgaard.
Sure.
But I mean it in the best way.
Yep.
Oh, he was in Seven Psychopaths as well.
Ronnie was so cool, by the way. Just like a super nice guy. But the funny thing is, he's a method actor, so he was always
really?
A character. Yeah. And I remember it was just so creepy to talk to him on set because he was in, and he was just, you know, he just reminded me of every bully I'd ever dealt with in my life. Like
right.
The way he was looking at you, you know.
Right.
He had such a strong gaze. And I would be giving him maybe like a blocking direction and just like averting my eyes. Like, just like, all right, just step over that way next time. Like, cause he would just like look at me.
Right.
I was like, is he going to kill me? I don't know. That was a pretty cool experience. But yeah, really nice guy.
That's awesome. Cause yeah there's two scenes I'm thinking of where he has that crazy, terrifying gaze. There's one where he drives past the site where like his brother was last seen, right?
Yeah.
And then, no, hold on. No, he's waiting there. Uncle
That's,
John drives
yeah, his
by.
Intro scene, yeah.
Yeah. And he just sees him there, and he's just hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Uncle John sort of tries to casually ask him what he's up to or whatever.
That's my favorite scene in the movie, actually.
Right, because it's so ambiguous. Like, you feel like they both know what the other person is actually up to.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of subtext.
But maybe they don't. Like, maybe Ronnie Jean Blevins has no idea at
right.
this point. But then... Later on, when Uncle John's with this like chorus of buddies that he has in the diner, including the great Don Forstin, Ronnie Jean Blevins is like sitting a couple tables away, and he's just like staring like daggers into the back of Uncle John's head.
Yep,
and it's super awesome. I think it's very creepy.
Yeah, I got lucky as well in that scene because we had one day to shoot all the diner scenes.
You had one day.
One day.
Because there are like four scenes.
Three.
There are three scenes.
Three
okay.
scenes. But I remember thinking, I mean, the windows faced west, so I was like, man, it would be really perfect if the sun came out for the last scene that we shoot, because it's supposed to take place in the morning, A, but the light wouldn't be nice, B, but C, I'm like, Ronnie should get that really hard light for that scene, because it's very intense, and the whole day it was cloudy, which was great for the other scenes, you know, easier to shoot when it's overcast like that, But I remember thinking, like, man, I'm getting really bummed about this last scene already. Like, I just want it. And then just a stroke of luck, you know, right when we were going to shoot, the clouds broke, the sun came out, and it was just like, thank you.
So the clouds literally parted for you.
Yeah, you could say that.
Nice.
I just remember being just, like, so thrilled. Like, yes, like, we have to shoot right now, because I thought it was going to go away.
Yeah.
I love that shot of Ronnie. Because just eating his eggs in like the most menacing way. And I just think that the hard sunlight, just the shadows, just accentuates that look. So
yeah, right. Whoever thought that eggs could be so disturbing?
Yeah.
So like, you know, I don't know, whenever you see in a movie like pictures of like a family or whatever, you know, just family photos and like whatever from the past, it seems like, I always wonder how much of those are real and how much of those are forgeries.
Sure.
And so there's a scene where Alex Moffat is sort of creepily like Facebook stalking Jenna Ling, and it's just a lot of Facebook pictures of her.
Yep.
And I was wondering like how many of those are real. How does that work? Like, what's the actual method to doing that?
They were all real.
No shit.
All on her Facebook. I mean, I'm sure she gave permission. You know. And basically, yeah, me and Steven spent, you know, maybe half a day. This is
Facebook stalking her.
Yeah, this is months after the production wrapped. We just had like a pickup day where we just shot a computer screen of pictures.
Right.
So, yeah. And then, you know, all the typing and all that stuff. And there were some additional animations that they put in there on their own.
Mm.
But, yeah, all those pictures are they're hers.
So, okay.
Yeah, from life.
That's,
yeah.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That'd be a lot of work if you had to make a whole person's, you know.
Yeah, well, I figured it wasn't the whole thing, but.
Right. Maybe with a bigger budget, you know, but.
Right, right.
No, they were hers.
All right. So how many years did Stephen Pyatt and Eric Crary, the co-writers and the director and producer, respectively, how long have you been, I guess, working with them?
Sure. As of this moment, it's around 3 years. So we knew each other a little less than a year once the shoot rolled around. So it all happened kind of fast. But they've known each other for a while, I want to say 7 or 8 years, so... Eric lived in L.A. He was actually David Lynch's assistant slash producer.
Wow.
Yeah, for a while.
So that was before they met?
Yeah, and then he moved back here from L.A. in 2008, or I think something like that. Started working for Foundation, which is where Pyatt worked at the time. So that's where they met.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he was an assistant on, Eric was an assistant on Inland Empire then probably.
I believe he's actually credited as a producer on Inland Empire.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Never saw that movie. Not really.
I did not like it.
I don't think that's my, okay. I don't think it'd be my cup of tea. But
no.
Yeah.
It was not mine. I couldn't make it. I stopped that for like 45 minutes.
Gotcha.
I really didn't like Mulholland Drive, I have to say. I
wasn't a fan of that movie
either. Yeah. And it was like Mulholland Drive, but for 3 hours instead of 2 hours. And with fewer lesbians, so... I don't know if this is gonna make it, but like this is good stuff though. This kind of ripping on Mulholland Drive.
All I remember is Naomi Watts.
Yeah, what?
So, and like the giant garbage monster.
Garbage monster. Yeah, it comes out of nowhere and there's no explanation, and it never appears again.
I was just like, you know what? Like, fuck that movie. Right? What is that, like, all about?
Behind a McDonald's or something?
Yeah.
Or some weird. It's like a Big Boy. David Lynch loves Big Boy. It was probably a Big Boy.
Really?
Yeah.
There's a thing for Big Boy.
Yeah, he like goes to. A certain Big Boy in LA all the time.
Really?
Cool. I have a director that I know out there, and he says that there's like two diners that he goes to. One is a particular Big Boy, and then the other one is like a pie shop.
Doesn't surprise me. Eric has one funny anecdote. I remember when he was producing, I don't know if it was Inland, but he was working for him, and they were staying at this hotel. They were out of town. It was this like really nice, you know, probably Ritz style 5-star hotel.
Mm.
And Lynch was really upset because they didn't allow smoking in the rooms. He's like, Eric, like, we gotta get out of here. There's no smoking. He's just like causing a scene. And Eric's like, oh god. So he found like a Super 8 or some, you know, like really divey motel. And he's like, Lynch could not have just been happier there. Like, just smoking like a chimney.
They probably had like a 24-hour kitchen. He's just like eating pancakes or something.
I love that little story.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That fits too.
It totally does fit.
Kind of along those lines. So like, while you're with John Ashton, mm-hmm. and he's just like, a badass smoking cigars. Good Eddie Murphy anecdotes. And why was he not in Beverly Hills Cop 3?
I can't speak to why he was not in 3. I don't know. I feel bad. I've never seen those movies. I like need to see
you
them.
Should.
I know.
God damn it.
Quite honestly, yeah, I'm the worst. he gave me one interesting Eddie Murphy story, which isn't super dramatic or anything. But basically, Eddie Murphy... I don't know. I'm sure you know. He's kind of notorious for just being a diva.
Yeah.
At least back in the day. He was just tough to work with. So it was some scene in a nightclub or a strip club, or I'm not sure, that... Oh, now I'm gonna butcher it. But it was something where Eddie Murphy either didn't want to show up or just didn't show up or said, I'm only going to be here at this time, after they had gotten everything ready.
Mm-hmm.
So what they had to do is they had to shoot...
I think this is 2, right?
I don't know. Again,
this is 2.
I'm the worst. So what they had to do was shoot everything without him and then go back and redo flip everything back, lighting, staging, camera, just to shoot like his shots only. Because he refused to be there at a certain time and they had everything booked already. and everything was, the ball was already in motion. It couldn't be stopped. So the crew had to pull like a ridiculous 20-hour day or something because of this.
So it's like when a celebrity has a commercial, they're only going to be there for 4 hours or whatever, that kind of thing. It's like you'll be there for half the day.
But I don't want to like ruin this or butcher the story, but yeah, it was something to where he just like refused to be there except at a certain time, which was not part of the original plan, which screwed everything up. But there was nothing anyone could do because it was Eddie Murphy. So yeah, that was the one story that I remember him telling me about that.
I bet those two. I'm pretty sure it was two because I remember.
Okay.
Except every 80s R-rated movie has a scene where the cops go through the strip club and they're like, oh, this is outrageous, you know? But they're always there and they're always, you know, boobs because it has to be an R-rated movie for something.
What do you think of Black Rain? Do you like Black Rain?
You know, like, I thought I would have really loved it.
Oh, but you don't like it?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I just didn't love it. I was expecting to love it because it has, like, super 80s score. Yeah. I want to say it's from Vangelis. I could be wrong.
I don't know that.
Yeah, whatever, I'm not gonna look at it.
That's just to me the quintessential
80s movie.
Yeah, like 80s action.
Because it has like Michael Douglas wearing like leather jackets and like having Michael Douglas hair.
Yep.
And Ridley Scott directed it at the height of his like 80s-ness.
Yep.
And it has like 80s-ified Greg Allman on the soundtrack, which is important. And a lot of cool Ray-Bans and a lot of cool fight scenes. And I think like a fuck ton of atmospheric lighting.
Just very stylized lighting. Yeah, yeah. Gotta love it. Yeah. Unmotivated.
Just neon. Just
neon and just beams of light everywhere. Yeah.
People want a lot of chemicals, I feel like.
Yeah.
Yeah, Michael Douglas is 80s as fuck. So is Eddie Murphy, really. Because, I mean, like, what has he done since 1992?
Dr. Doolittle.
Yeah. I mean, I know, like, not a professor, but what of Substance? It all stopped after Boomerang. That's my theory.
I've never seen Boomerang either.
Well, creatively, I feel like it was all downhill. But that was it. And then, bam.
Yeah, well.
Wait, let me... Hold on.
Can't stay on the top forever, you know?
You know, actually, Bowfinger wasn't that bad.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He was really good in a dual role, playing himself, basically, and his dork brother.
Sure.
Oh, wait. So, John Ashton, did he tell you why he didn't do Beverly Hills Cop 3? Because, his character was kind of replaced by Hector Elizondo, but it wasn't... His character was a different guy.
Sure.
So, like, they respected that his character existed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They didn't out and out replace him.
I never asked directly.
Damn.
And I don't recall him. Yeah, sorry. Sorry to disappoint.
Sorry.
I didn't even know if there was any sort of drama there. I didn't realize he wasn't in the third one. So, okay. I didn't even know to ask, yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. That is definitely what I was wondering. Because Judge Reinhold is in it, and, like, John Ashton and Judge Reinhold are like the two other cops.
Okay.
Well, there's one scene where he like puts a banana in like the tailpipe of their car to evade them and stuff because they're tailing him because they think he's related to a series of crimes that somehow made their way from Detroit to Beverly Hills and he's followed them.
I see.
Anyway, so at first they have an antagonistic relationship in the first one and then after a while he's just like, oh man, that Beverly Hills cop of ours. Always up to mischief. Axel Foley, causing trouble. But, yeah, okay, I think those are most of my questions.
Okay.
So what's next for you? What's your next, you got another feature cooking?
Not as of yet. Always looking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for now it's just keeping the nose to the grindstone, as it were. Yeah, so I don't know. For now, it's commercial stuff here.
Mm.
Always keeping the eye open for other opportunities. So,
ESPN projects coming up?
Not that I know of. Although our FIFA documentary went over really well.
Oh, sweet!
Back in May when it aired, and
this was before the guy got fired or resigned or whatever.
No one. Well, yeah, he resigned, but. I'm actually not certain he ever left.
Oh, really? I thought the Prince was going to run.
The Prince did run.
I thought he was going to run again after this guy.
Well, I haven't kept up with that drama, actually. I know they're extraditing one of the people they arrested to the States.
Okay.
I haven't kept up with that. But it was well received, and to my understanding, they want to do one of those a year. So I'm not sure what the next topic is going to be, but there are a few ideas on the table for a similar scope project.
Right.
Hopefully first quarter of next year.
Yeah.
Because that'd be great when it's not a whole cold lot's going in Chicago. Yeah.
See, I feel like they should do another FIFA one because, like, this is a very interesting series of developments we've had.
You know, they actually, they did a bit of an update to it, which I wasn't available to go do, but they went back to Zurich for a couple days to shoot another interview.
So, oh, for, like, reruns and stuff?
Yeah, just because the story is pretty much ongoing, developing, like, as we speak. So,
Yeah, they're, like, delightfully corrupt. It's pretty fun.
I love how they released a movie. Do you know?
Yeah, Tim Roth, right?
Maybe. I don't know.
I think it was Tim Roth. Let's check this out. But also, why would Tim... Well, you know, I know why. Money.
For the money. Yeah. But I remember seeing a headline where it only grossed $682 or something like that.
Yeah, and it came out in, like, one theater.
Yeah, United Passions. Oh, my gosh.
They must have, like, had a decent budget because they got Tim Roth and Sam Neill.
Yeah, big budget for sure.
I guess, obviously, right? Because, like, there was one guy that was a FIFA executive that had a separate penthouse in, like,
New York. Tim Roth plays Sepp Blatter?
Wait, Tim Roth plays Sepp Blatter?
I have to see this movie. Oh, Neill plays Havelange. Interesting.
And
is this funny because I know all these people now?
Right.
Dude, Jeff Pardew is in it.
Wow.
They had quite a cast for this movie.
That is an old IMDb picture of Jared Pardew. He is not nearly that skinny at this point in his life. it's all dudes, apparently, in this movie.
Yeah, apparently. Great.
Oh, Jemima West. One woman.
Thank God for that.
What a relief. Okay, anyway, I think, that'll do her.
Cool.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today, Mike, and congratulations again on the feature.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Filmcore. What a relief. Okay, anyway, I think, that'll do her.
Cool.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today, Mike, and congratulations again on the feature.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. This was fun.